it's hard not to overlook the irony that we just listened to on the BBC News. The Organization of American States has voted to allow Cuba back into their organization. The United States is opposing that until Cuba institutes democratic reforms. My comment, when are we going to have democracy in the United States? And if you do think we do, just look at the single-payer issue and the fact that the majority of Americans want single-payer, and Congress will not even discuss it. There's some very powerful ads on the back page of the Sacramento News and Review. The organization that is putting them on is called Every37.com. And as I read you the ad, you'll understand why it's called that. Going through the windshield is such a buzzkill. Basking in the warm, fuzzy afterglow of a night out, you joke that you just want to get home and crash. But you only succeed in one of the two. In one jagged, crumpled, blood-soaked moment, unimaginable suffering is instantly and unevenly distributed amongst you, your victim, and the families. Or maybe it doesn't go down like that. Maybe you've planned ahead. Maybe you have friends who say, "Are you sure you're okay to drive?" And, "Seriously, dude, let me give you a ride." How do you return this kindness? Should you thank them and accept? Or shrug it off and bet convenience against horror one more time? The answer is painfully obvious, and yet every 37 minutes, someone ignores the odds and kills someone else. Could you please just not gamble with other people's lives? That was this week's, last week's. Discover the joy of prison food. Have a toilet conveniently located right next to your bed. Learn how shivs are made. Turn showering into a social event. So many new and exciting experiences await when you kill someone with your car. Manslaughter. It's like murder, except you didn't mean it. It was all a big mistake. Your new roommates will understand, unless they too have lost someone to drunk driving. In Sacramento, it's hard to find someone who hasn't. If you've been out drinking and find yourself craving the comforts of home, get a ride. Call a taxi. Walk. Otherwise, you might find yourself away from home with lots of time you wish you had. Those ads are on the back of the Sacramento News and Review, and they're, I guess, paid for because they're from every37.com. Powerful stuff. All right, first item. Wisconsin court upholds GPS tracking by police. The article's by Ryan J. Foley in the ChicagoTribune.com. An appeals court ruled Thursday that Wisconsin police can attach GPS to cars to secretly track anybody's movements without obtaining search warrants. However, the District Court of Appeals said it was more than a little troubled by that conclusion and asked Wisconsin lawmakers to regulate GPS use to protect against abuse by police and private individuals. As the law currently stands, this is Wisconsin law, the court said police can mount GPS on cars to track people without violating their constitutional rights, even if the drivers aren't suspects. Officers do not need to get warrants beforehand because GPS tracking does not involve a search or seizure. This means that police are seemingly free to secretly track anyone's public movements with a GPS device, the Chief Justice wrote. One privacy advocate said the decision opened the door for greater government surveillance of citizens. Meanwhile, law enforcement officials called the decision a victory for public safety because tracking devices are an increasingly important tool in investigating criminal behavior. Where have we heard that one before? The ruling came in a 2003 case involving a Madison man who was under investigation for stalking. Police got a warrant to put a GPS in his car and secretly attached it while the vehicle was parked in his driveway. The device recorded his car's movements for 5 weeks before police retrieved it and downloaded the information. The information suggested that he was indeed stalking the woman, who'd gone to police earlier with suspicions. Police got a second warrant to search his car and home, found more evidence, and arrested him. He was convicted of stalking and sentenced to prison. In his appeal, he argued the tracking violated his Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure. He argued the device followed him into areas out of public view, such as his garage. The court disagreed. The tracking did not violate constitutional protection because the device only gave police information that could have been obtained through visual surveillance. Even though the device followed his car to private places, an officer tracking him could have seen when his car entered or exited a garage. Attaching the device was not a violation, the judges decided, because his driveway is a public place. The legal director of the ACLU in Wisconsin said using GPS to track someone's car goes beyond observing them in public and should require a warrant. Now, let's keep in mind that in this particular case, they did have a warrant, but the ruling is questionable. The idea that you can go and attach anything you want to someone else's property without any court supervision, that's wrong, he said. Without a warrant, they can do that on anybody they want. So in this particular instance of stalking, they did have a warrant, but the court ruling was that they didn't need the warrant. And that, some people might consider troubling. Okay, my commentary for today, June the 3rd. It's been reported in the American Free Press that the Bilderberger Society is having their annual meeting this time in Greece, and it's right around now. And I find it very interesting that our President Barack Obama is traveling in the Middle East now. And one has to wonder if that's a convenience. Keep in mind that many years ago, I believe it was Eisenhower, there was some time missing from his engagement calendar. And the government offered the excuse, well, he was off seeing a dentist. And it was later established that, in fact, he went out to Edwards Air Force Base and was either briefed or met aliens that were at that base. So there is a history of presidents suddenly disappearing for brief periods of time, and one might conjecture that Obama's visit coupled with the Bilderberger meetings. It's interesting. But it's conjecture. Okay. This one has been established by Snoops.com as being accurate. The newest virus circulating is the UPS FedEx delivery failure. You will receive an email from UPS or FedEx service along with a packet number. It will say that they were unable to deliver a package sent to you on such and such a date. It then asks you to print out the invoice copy attached. Do not print this out. It launches the virus. Pass this warning on to PC operators at work and home. And again, this was confirmed by Snoops.com. That's a real virus. Next item. If we want to know what torture is and what it does to human beings, we have to look at it squarely without flinching. That's just what a powerful and important film, seen by far too few Americans, does. Torturing Democracy was written and produced by one of America's outstanding documentary reporters, Sherry Jones. Torturing Democracy begins at 9/11 and recounts how the Bush White House and the Pentagon decided to make coercive detention and abusive interrogation the official U.S. policy in the War on Terror. In sometimes graphic detail, the documentary describes the experiences of several men who were held in custody, and it lists three of the men, all of whom eventually were released. Charges never were filed against them, and no reason was ever given for their years in custody, nor their torture. The documentary traces how tactics meant to train American troops to survive enemy interrogations, the famous Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape program, became the basis for many of the methods employed by the CIA and by interrogators at Guantanamo and in Iraq, including waterboarding, sleep and sensory deprivation, shackling, caging, painful stress positions, and sexual humiliation. Quote, "We have recreated our enemies' methodologies in Guantanamo." This is a quote from Malcolm Nance, former head of the Navy's SEER training program. He adds, "It will hurt us for decades to come. Decades. Our people will all be subjected to these tactics because we have authorized them for the world now. How it got to Guantanamo is a crime, and somebody needs to figure out who did it, how they did it, and who authorized them to do it, because our servicemen will suffer for years." Close quote. Related item. A Rhode Island Democratic lawmaker says he'll donate $100 to charity for every second Former President George Bush withstands waterboarding. State Representative Ron Driver sent letters making the offer to Bush, as well as to former Vice President Dick Cheney and ex-Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Bush's administration allowed the interrogation technique, which simulates drowning, to be used on terrorism suspects. Driver says if Bush is confident it isn't torture, he should try it. His offer was reported Wednesday in the Westerly Sun. A representative for Condoleezza Rice said she would not participate, while Bush and Cheney's offices did not return calls seeking comment. Cheney has defended waterboarding, saying it yielded important information. And then we have a reader comment to that web posting. One, I'll chip in an extra $100 if they manage to extract any intelligence from Bush. Two, or we could waterboard Cheney for donations to reduce the deficit. We could balance the budget in no time. My comment. Assuming Cheney is accurate and important information can be divulged, imagine how much we might learn by waterboarding him. Like who sat in on and helped decide our energy policy during his secret meetings that enabled Enron to rip off California? And maybe more of the truth concerning 9/11. I say that in the interest of national security and national sanity, we should waterboard Big Dick. If ever there was a candidate for extracting information from someone who knows, Big Dick is high on the list. Another related item. Finally, we have a conservative radio host who has the courage of his convictions. His convictions only lasted 6 seconds, but we must applaud him for being willing to put his money where his mouth is, and in this case, his health. This is from rawstory.com. Conservative radio host gets waterboarded and lasts 6 seconds before saying it's torture. Chicago radio host Eric Mankow Mueller decided he'd get himself waterboarded to prove the technique wasn't torture. It didn't turn out quite that way. Mankow, in fact, lasted just 6 or 7 seconds before crying uncle. Apparently, the experience went pretty badly. Witnesses said Mueller thrashed on the table and even instantly threw the toy cow he was holding as his emergency tool to signify when he wanted the experiment to stop. This was according to NBC Chicago. Quote, "The average person can take this for 14 seconds," Marine Sergeant Clay South told his audience before he was waterboarded on air. "He's going to wiggle, he's going to scream, he's going to wish he never did this." Mankow was set on a 7-foot-long table with his legs elevated and his feet tied. "I wanted to prove it wasn't torture," Mankow said. "They cut off our heads. We put water on their faces. I got voted to do this, but I really thought, I'm going to laugh this off. The upshot, it's way worse than I thought it would be, and it's no joke," Mankow told listeners. "It is such an odd feeling to have water poured down your nose with your head back. It was instantaneous, and I don't want to say this, absolute torture." "Absolutely. I mean, that's drowning," he added later. "It's the feeling of drowning. I knew it was going to be this. If I knew it was going to be this bad, I would have not done it," he said. Well, that's one blow hard down, and hopefully more to follow. We eagerly await Dick Cheney, George Bush, John Yoo, and Judge Jay Bybee to volunteer next to prove that waterboarding is not torture. Next item. Governor Arnie gave a speech to the California Assembly yesterday, and excerpts were broadcast on NPR. "I don't know about you, but I was very impressed. He didn't mince words. He spoke truth. He spoke eloquently, and his words were nonpartisan. Once you get beyond his accent, he's quite a profound speaker, quite a statesman. I don't consider him a Republican. I consider him a very good, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic governor. And when you think of the self-serving clowns who preceded him, he looks terrific." Next item. A listener sent this in. It's called Economics 101, and it's something to think about. In a small town on the south coast of France, the holiday season is in full swing, but it's raining, so there's not too much business happening. Everyone is heavily in debt. Luckily, a rich tourist arrives in the foyer of a small local hotel. He asks for a room and puts a 100-euro note on the reception counter, takes a key, and goes to inspect the room located upstairs on the third floor. The hotel owner takes the banknote in a hurry and rushes to his meat supplier, to whom he owes 100 euro. The butcher takes the money and races to his supplier to pay his debt. The wholesaler rushes to the farmer to pay 100 euro for pigs he purchased some time ago. The farmer triumphantly gives the 100 euro note to a local prostitute, who gave him the services on credit. The prostitute goes quickly to the hotel and gives the 100 to the owner, as she was owing the hotel for her hourly room use to entertain clients. At that moment, the rich tourist comes down to reception and informs the hotel owner that the proposed room is unsatisfactory, and he takes back his 100 euro note and departs. Notice that there was no profit or income for anyone. But everyone no longer has any debt, and the people of this one small town look optimistically toward their future. Question: could this be the solution to the global financial crisis? Next item, signs of progress out of India. The Indian Parliament just elected its Speaker of the House and chose its first woman as Speaker. That's revolutionary in itself, but perhaps more revolutionary is that that woman is from the Dalit class, the untouchables. Slowly, the world grows a little more sane. Last item, this is from Anonymous off the net. I was visiting my two friends who are liberal Democrats. I asked my friend's little girl what she wanted to be when she grows up. She said she wanted to be president someday. So I asked her, well, if you were president, what would be the first thing you'd do? She replied, I'd give food and houses to all the homeless people. Wow, what a worthy goal, I told her. But you don't have to wait until you're president to do that. You can come over to my house, pull weeds, mow the lawn, and sweep my yard. I'll pay you $50. Then I'll take you over to the grocery store where that homeless guy hangs out, and you can give him the $50 to use toward food and a new house. She thought that over for a few seconds while her mother glared at me. Then she looked me straight in the eye and asked, why doesn't the homeless guy come over and do the work, and you can just pay him the $50? I said, welcome to the Republican Party. Her parents still aren't talking to me. Okay, the time is 25 past noon. The station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamberlain, and the name of the show is Rabble Rousing. On with the show. Mr. Obama, resign right now. This is by Ted Rawl. He's writing in SmirkingChimp.com. With Democrats like him, who needs dictators? We expected broken promises. But the gap between the soaring expectations that accompanied Barack Obama's inauguration and his wretched performance is the broadest such chasm in recent historical memory. This guy makes Bill Clinton look like a paragon of integrity and follow-through. From health care, to torture, to the economy, to war, Obama has reneged on pledges real and implied. So timid and so owned is he, that he trembles in fear of offending, of all things, the government of Turkey. Obama has officially reneged on his campaign promise to acknowledge the Armenian genocide. When a president doesn't have the nads to annoy the Turks, why does he bother to show up for work in the morning? Obama is useless. Worse than that, he's dangerous. Which is why, if he has any patriotism left after the thousands of meetings he sat through with corporate contributors, blood-sucking lobbyists, and corporate politicians, he ought to step down now before he drags us further into the abyss. I refer here to Obama's plan for preventative detentions. If a cop or other government official thinks you might want to commit a crime someday, you could be held in prolonged detention. Reports in U.S. state-controlled media imply that Obama's shocking new policy would only apply to Islamic terrorists, or in this case, wannabe Islamic terrorists, and also kind of, sort of, maybe thinking about terrorism dudes, as if that made it okay. In practice, Obama wants to let government goons snatch you, me, and anyone else they deem annoying off the street. Preventative detention is the classic, defining characteristic of a military dictatorship. Because dictatorial regimes rely on fear rather than consensus, their priority is self-preservation rather than improving their people's lives. They worry obsessively over the one thing they can't control, what Orwell called thought crime, contempt for rules that might someday translate to taking direct action. Locking up people who haven't done anything wrong is worse than un-American, and a violent attack on the most basic principles of Western jurisprudence. It is contrary to the most essential notion of human decency. That anyone has ever been subjected to preventative detention is an outrage. that the President of the United States, a man who won an election because he promised to elevate our moral and political discourse, would even entertain such revolting idea, offends the idea of civilization itself. Obama is cute. He's charming. But there's something rotten inside of him. Unlike the Republicans who backed Bush, I wouldn't follow a terrible leader just because I voted for him. Obama has revealed himself. He's a monster, and he should remove himself from power. Prolonged detention, reported the New York Times, would be inflicted upon, quote, terrorism suspects who cannot be tried, close quote. Cannot be tried? Interesting choice of words. Any terrorism suspect. Can you be a suspect if you haven't been charged with a crime? Any terrorism suspect can be tried. Anyone can be tried for anything. At this writing, a Somali child is sitting in a prison in New York, charged with piracy in the Indian Ocean, where the U.S. has no jurisdiction. Anyone can be tried. Why is it exactly that some prisoners cannot be tried? The old gray lady explains why Obama wants this, the old gray lady being the New York Times. The old gray lady explains why Obama wants this entirely new chapter in American law in a boring little sentence buried in a couple past the jump and a couple of hundred words down page A16. Quote, yet another question is what to do with the most problematic group of Guantanamo detainees, those who pose a national security threat but cannot be prosecuted, either for lack of evidence or because evidence is tainted. Close quote. In democracies with functioning legal systems, it's assumed that people against whom there is a lack of evidence are innocent. They walk free. In countries where the rule of law prevails, in places blessedly free of fearful leaders who only concern is staying in power, tainted evidence is no evidence at all. If you can't prove that a defendant committed a crime, an actual crime, not a thought crime, in a fair trial, you release him and apologize to the judge and jury for wasting their time. It is amazing and incredible, after 8 years of Bush's lawless behavior, to have to still have to explain these things. For that reason alone, Obama should resign. Ted Rall, writing in SmirkingChimp.com. Next article is entitled, Milk is a Gateway Drug to Bourbon. This is from RawStory.com. At long last, someone in Congress with the courage to speak truth to the war on marijuana. You have never before seen, nor will you ever see again. FBI Director Robert Mueller so thoroughly humbled in a discourse about drug policy before the United States Congress. In this instance, Representative Steve Cohen, Democrat of Tennessee, gets Mueller to admit that marijuana has never killed anyone, then smashes into tiny bits the decades-old gateway drug argument with a unique analogy of milk and bourbon. Mueller cites the old tired line that parents of kids who died from drugs always say the kids used marijuana first. Representative Cohen immediately replies, they first use milk, then beer, then bourbon, then marijuana, before turning to the more dangerous drugs. I'm sorry, sir, but the gateway drug theory simply has no validity. After this article, which included a CNN video of the dialogue, there were some comments posted. Here are two of them. And don't forget peanut butter. I'm more than willing to bet that 100% of all drug users, both legal and illegal, did peanut butter first. Peanut butter is the ultimate gateway drug. Then there was one signed Medicinic. Speaking of gateways to hell, the war on drugs has been a gateway to a police state, resulting in a total loss of privacy, unconstitutional asset forfeiture laws, no-knock raids, and jails stuffed with poor souls convicted of victimless crimes. Isn't our parasitic and murderous military-industrial complex sufficient cause for national shame? Must we add to it a rapidly metastasizing prison-industrial complex that is equally parasitic and murderous? Forget about legalization of marijuana. Let's move on to decriminalization. And while we're at it, let's decriminalize all the other substances that are now banned. Why did the people of a supposedly free country ever allow the state to dictate what they may or may not put in their bodies? Who owns our bodies? We or the state? America's drug laws are only about a century old and of a racist impulse. Their origin is in the early anti-opium wars intended to harass Chinese immigrants. Prior to then, Americans were pretty much free to do with their bodies as they pleased. Drug addiction was no worse than today, and society was free of the violence and corruption caused by hysterical drug prohibition. Tobacco and alcohol are a far greater health hazard, yet both are tolerated if not celebrated. We needn't search far to find widely popular substances that have created a national health calamity: sugar, aspartame, high fructose corn syrup, MSG, and hydrogenated fats, all found in the most common processed foods, are a leading cause of disease and death in America. Yet children are willfully exposed to these poisons, and no one is serving jail time for doing so. Our meat is pumped full of dangerous hormones and antibiotics, and our crops are raised using toxic, nutrient-depleting artificial fertilizers and pesticides. Our drinking water is now laced with prescription drugs, peddled to a gullible public desperate for a quick fix to disease caused by their unhealthy eating habits. Yet our public servants are annually wasting tens of billions of taxpayers' money jailing people for what they smoke, snort, and shoot into their veins. This is institutional hypocrisy and national madness on an epic scale. Today we are appalled that our ancestors tortured and burned people at the stake for being witches. Years from now, enlightened people will shake their heads in disbelief that Americans gutted their precious Bill of Rights so that busybodies could punish millions of people for what they put in their bodies. That was the comment. The article ends with this comment from the poster: "My God, some actual sanity coming from someone in Congress. And it's about time to see the whole gateway drug BS getting shut down right as it comes out of the horse's butt. Nice to see some actual truth being spoken. Write, call, or email your Congress jerks and the President. Tell them it's time to stop this nonsense. We can't afford to keep ruining people's lives over a health issue, especially since prescription drugs are where kids are getting their fixes nowadays. It's a war on adults and their ability to make their own choices. You want to stop kids from getting cannabis so easily? Make it legal. It's far more difficult for them to get a hold of alcohol than cannabis, just like alcohol was easy for them to get in the 20s under Prohibition. When is this country going to learn from its own history and grow up?" That article was from rawstory.com. And it's interesting to note that California is now in a budget crisis. And Governor Arne even said several weeks ago that it might be time to consider taxing cannabis as a revenue source for the state of California. Wouldn't it be hysterically funny and perfectly American if cannabis is finally decriminalized or legalized, not on its merits, but for economic reasons? You got to love the irony in that. Okay, the next one's by Mark Morford. He writes in the San Francisco Gate, which is the San Francisco Chronicle. I like the way he writes, as well as his perspective. This is on the big gay shrug. "Sorry, enemies of gay marriage. Proposition 8 or no, you've already lost. Here's a fun thing to do to calm your frazzled, saddened nerves in the wake of the California Supreme Court's very unfortunate, but also merely annoying and karmically fleeting Proposition 8 decision. Head on down to your local high school. Hell, make it a junior high or even an elementary, and take yourself an informal survey. Ask the various wary, bepimpled youth of Generation Tweet what they think about these scary gay people getting married. Ask them in your most panicky, alarmist, mortified voice, aren't they horrified at the very idea? Aren't they shocked at the very thought of two people in love having their union officially recognized and validated by the state? Don't they know the musty old Bible mutters some barely coherent mistranslated silliness about it in a single word or two, written 1,500 years ago in a long-dead language by acidic church elders with power-mad political agendas and violently repressed libidos who nevertheless wish to instruct us all on how to live and love and screw? Please note this response. Please observe how the kids merely look at you as though you're more than a little bit deranged and prehistoric. So out of touch, you might as well be Dick Cheney, talking up the diesel-powered rectal thermometers he so loved back in World War I. Watch carefully as they sigh and roll their eyes, then whip out their Nokias to text their friends about how this creepy elder just tried to convince them that the harmless, yawningly commonplace homosexuality currently saturating the popular culture all around them, from fashion to Facebook, movies to American Idol, is not only wrong, but so wrong that the law should ban it forever because, well, no one really seems to know why exactly. Did you see it? That big, sighing shrug of, what the hell is wrong with you? Combined with lots of, who the hell cares? Because that's the reaction to note most of all. Here is what it tells you. Gay marriage is a foregone conclusion. It's a done deal. It's just a matter of time. For the next generation in particular, equal rights for gays is not even a question or a serious issue, much less a sinful, hysteric conundrum that it can only be answered by terrified Mormons and confused old people and inane referendums funded by SAME. It's just obvious, inevitable, a given. Let us hereby be reminded, before sadness and frustration overwhelm once more, Proposition 8 and its ilk are merely the last fitful gasps of a long-dying ideology, markers of a certain kind of sad conservative desperation. They are the final clawings and scrapings of a reactionary worldview that attempts to outlaw and punish all it cannot, will not understand. Same as it ever was, really. The pattern is as old as fear itself. Remember, only rarely does true progress appear in a single momentous Obama-like shift that reverberates across the planet and changes everything in an instant. Most frequently, it comes in fits and starts and hiccups, small lurches, and hard-fought battles, shot through with little spitballs of hate and intolerance and heaps of misunderstanding. You know, just like now. Evidence, plenty. Just look at the numbers. Support for gay marriage is now at its highest it's been in American history. Okay, he goes on and on, but I think you got his point. Let's see if there's any more here. You can say then that we're right at the tipping point. You can say that very soon indeed, sooner than many people expect, in fact, we'll all look back on this inane gay marriage hysteria and wonder, what the hell was that all about? What the hell were we thinking? And by the way, as for massive schizophrenic California, well, what can we say? In our convoluted, lurching two steps forward, eight steps sideways sort of quasi-progressive way, we flail and flip and frequently fail. It's just our way. Okay. Do not misunderstand. Setbacks like this Proposition 8 decision are painful and even cruel, and the gay couples and activists who've been at the forefront of the fight since the beginning are nothing short of heroic. Like civil rights activists of any stripe before them, the subsequent generations who will take gay rights for granted will have them to thank forevermore for paving the way and fighting the good fight. What's more, there's still an enormous amount of work to be done. New referendums, protests, fundraisers, and awareness raisings. The change will not come without help and push. Hate and homophobia still seethe in myriad pockets of the culture and the populace at large, even trickling down to dumb blonde silicon-injected beauty pageant runner-ups who parrot the same childlike religious misinformation her handlers have pumped into her kind for 2,000 wickedly patriarchal years. But these setbacks are not insurmountable roadblocks. They're merely obnoxious speed bumps on what social conservatives see as our nation's ungodly highway to hell. They only slow us down a little. A new campaign in the fight for marriage equality is already taking shape. Evolution is happening. The energy and momentum are unstoppable. Simply put, the ignorance and homophobia that fueled and funded Prop 8 in the first place will not stand. Don't believe it? Hey, just ask your kids. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hi, I was just listening to your dissertation on what's happening recently with Proposition 8 and everything.
Right.
I was wondering, have you heard the, I heard this theory a long time ago. I heard it in, I was in Sierra College, about every so often America goes through this born-again sweep of religion. And 20 years after that, it has a very big effect on the country. One of them was, of course, this is just a theory, historically speaking, was the just prior to the Civil War, 20 years before the Civil War, there was a huge born-again sweep of religious faith through the northeastern part of the country, which then caused a huge rift, religiously speaking, in the country, where half of your country, religiously speaking, went anti-slavery, pointing to the Bible and saying, this is against God, against religion. And I was wondering if 20 years ago, when we went through the 80s and all that born-again stuff, if this isn't the effects of that, the anti-gay thing. Of course, it is. I see it as just one last gasp myself, but I also see it as one last gasp of the religious far right here on this issue. And not sure that it will be settled for about 4 or 5 years.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. You have a great day.
You too. Bye.
The next article is called The Audacity of Dopes. It's by William K. Black, Associate Professor, University of Missouri. He was a senior regulator during the savings and loan debacle, and he's the author of the book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. This was published by Huffington Post. We're being played for chumps. The Bush and Obama plans could only have been designed by failed bankers, for their principal beneficiaries are failed bankers. We already know enough to confirm that the Bush administration made us the fool in the market by massively overpaying for assets. The Obama administration is about to compound the scandal with a guarantee program. The bankers that caused the crisis designed both programs. The senior officers at big banks aren't very good lenders, but they're expert in maximizing their compensation. Worse, Mr. Geithner, the senior public official who with former Treasury Secretary Paulson designed the failed Bush plan, is the architect of the disastrous Obama plan. Indeed, as the New York Times has just revealed, it should be called the Geithner plan. He overcame intense opposition within the Obama administration and designed a plan that's even worse than the failed Bush program. Geithner's gifts to the bankers that caused the crisis include an unnecessary taxpayer bailout of risk capital, a massive cover-up of their bank's insolvency, gutting the proposed limits on executive compensation, and devising a guarantee mechanism designed to hide the expenses of the unprincipled bailouts from the American public. Remember, executive compensation is not merely a fairness issue. Executive compensation and the compensation systems used for appraisers, accountants, and rating agencies were designed and served to create the perverse incentives and ethical rot that caused the ongoing financial crises by producing a Gresham's dynamic, in which fraudulent and abusive lending and accounting practices drove good practices out of the marketplace. Here's the amazing part. The bankers are so arrogant that they brag to a sympathetic CNBC commentator that they're playing this. Quote, "What a delicious irony this is. Last week, just as President Obama was publicly bashing the stupidity of the banks, his economic team was privately begging for input from Wall Street. The administration was conducting around-the-clock discussions and interviews with senior Wall Street executives, including many from the same firms he was theoretically appalled with, about how to fix the lingering financial crises." Close quote. There are proven ways to resolve the crisis that are far cheaper and more effective because they don't subsidize bankers and risk capital. We know how to resolve failed banks. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, can place even the largest banks in pass-through receivership on Friday at the close of business and reopen them as new federal banks Monday, with minimum disruption to customers and creditors, and retain going concern value. This is how the Reagan administration resolved failed SNLs during the debacle. The FDIC appoints a senior manager to ensure that New Federal is run prudently. There's plenty of unemployed banking talent available. Hundreds of good bankers lost their jobs during the financial bubble because they refused to make bad loans. Research has shown that its sister agency, FSLIC, appointed receivership managers that greatly reduced losses during the SNL debacle. Leaving the managers in charge of failed banks that they led into insolvency is suicidal. The new senior leader is picked based on expertise in prudent lending and integrity. If we want failed banks to return promptly to making good, prudent loans and help lead in economic recovery, an SNL-style new federal is the best possible device. The existing managers have terrible incentives to cover up existing losses and to make bad or even fraudulent loans that produce the greatest fictional accounting income and to live large through bonuses and perks. The Obama compensation limits are political cover. The bankers have designed the guarantee plan to ensure that the compensation limits will be illusory. The FDIC managers have the correct incentives to finally produce an honest evaluation in which assets are toxic and how much they're worth. This transparency is essential if we're to end the crisis. Under the Bush and Obama plans, we retain the existing managers that have overwhelming incentives to cover up their losses. The bankers have designed the guarantee plan to encourage banks to continue to cover up their toxic assets and not recognize their losses. These cover-ups make a financial crisis last longer and increase the taxpayers' costs. The FDIC managers preserve the going concern value by making prudent loans to get the new federal in shape to be acquired. By providing reliable information about the toxic assets, the managers reduce acquisition risks, which expands the number of bidders and reduces the financial assistance required to aid the acquisition. New federal receivership dramatically reduces cash needs. Most costs are deferred until the new federals are sold. Pass-through receiverships save the taxpayers money and prevent perverse managerial incentives because they do not subsidize risk capital when banks are insolvent. Common and preferred stock and subordinated debt in banks are risk capital. Their holders are supposed to receive nothing if a bank becomes insolvent, but the Bush and Obama plans reward them. There's no need to do this. Subsidizing risk capital and maintaining the failed managers at insolvent banks creates the worst possible incentives. It will cause future crises. It will delay the recovery from the ongoing crises. It robs the U.S. taxpayers and primarily benefits the wealthy, many of them non-U.S. citizens. The contract they made was that they would get nothing if the bank failed. It failed, and they're often complicit in those failures. The bankers have convinced the Bush and Obama administration that the taxpayers should be looted to bail out risk capital. We should stop listening to the folk that caused the crises and have interests hostile to our interests. Let's stop them from using us as chumps. That was William K. Black, and he was a senior regulator during the SNL debacle. And he's the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Might be interesting to have him on the show. I'll make a note of that, so if I can read my own notes, maybe I'll see about inviting him on. Will Conservatives Ever Wake Up? It's by Dennis Rakonin, writing in Smirking Chimp. I'm stopped at a red light when a decrepit old Chevy pickup with its windows rolled down pulls into the adjacent lane. Its radio is bleeding Rush Limbaugh. The driver looks disheveled and haggard, making it very easy to surmise that he's the perfect example of an American totally screwed over by capitalism run greedily amok, decisively abetted by conservative ideology. He's probably unemployed, has no medical insurance, no pension prospects, and is likely facing having a sheriff's deputies put his family's belongings out on the sidewalk following a heartbreaking eviction. But he's got that radio turned to right-wing propaganda, and he's so completely brainwashed that he thinks his greatest worries is gays getting married. He's undoubtedly convinced that the Democratic Socialist Party is ruining his life, not to mention his beloved country, and that liberals are the reason his wallet is thin to nothing but pictures of his gaunt spouse and sickly kids. Meanwhile, Limbaugh and other well-compensated voices of radio or television reaction live in luxury, exceeded in ill-gotten wealth only by the corporate fat cats who hire them to keep the masses from angrily identifying their true enemy. This allows the silk suits to laugh all the way to the bank and then lean back with mint juleps in their poolside gazebos, while poor bastards like my guy in that truck fart out the remains of their last unhealthy meal. Or maybe a little cheap beer. But here's the real kicker. A father from our area, pretty much like that Chevy dude, sent his son off to war a couple of years back. "There aren't any jobs here anyway, plus you'll learn a useful trade," he told his son. He did so with teary-eyed pride, emphatically believing both this nation's foreign policy myths and George Bush's lies. It was beyond his awareness to comprehend that the U.S. aggressing a sovereign country for fraudulent reasons, in blatant violation of international law, made us no different than Nazis attacking Poland in 1939 or the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. Despite letters from his boy that contained strange passages that a more critical soul will have seen as indicators of things on the battlefield being much different than what Republicans gloriously portrayed, Dad never let his patriotism waver. Publicized photos of Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse didn't faze him, because right-wing media explained it all to his manipulated satisfaction. Then one tragic day, his precious child got blown to bloody shards by a rocket-propelled grenade. Shortly thereafter, what was left of him came home in a box and was lowered beneath cemetery sod as a bugler played taps. The greatest tragedy, however, is that Dad will probably go to his own grave decades from now, still convinced that his hometown hero served a noble cause, never mind those many thousands of foreign innocents who were themselves violently killed because the Americans needlessly, wrongfully invaded. Or maybe at some clarifying moment, in otherwise foggy old age, he'll have an epiphany, understanding that his entire life was spent fleshing out a massive Fox News falsehood. That medal from the president, preserved posthumously, will suddenly lose its luster. It'll perhaps get hurled against a wall, leading nursing room residents to wonder what that bang was and the accompanied agonized scream were all about. That's what it sadly boils down to for rank-and-file conservatives. They'll either die entirely unreconstituted and unenlightened, clinging to absurdity until the very end, or they'll eventually see the light as the armor of their fallacies finally turns to full powdered rust. There's nothing worse than realizing, too late, that one's entire existence was spent living, breathing, sweating, and bleeding to advance somebody else's abysmally selfish, decidedly wicked agenda. That was Dennis Raconin writing at SmirkingChimp.com. Okay. Almost out of time. I think we got time for this. I love Fred Reed. Amongst his many other past lives, Fred Reed was an ex-Washington, D.C. newsman. He now lives in Mexico, from where he looks with jaundiced eyes at and writes with savage clarity about his former country, America. This one's called, "This Whole World Sucks and Everybody Thinks It's Gravity." I'm going to take poison. Every time I read the headlines, I want to take poison. Always they are a concentrated tale of avarice, wretched judgment, murderousness, and lubrigous, okay, I can't pronounce it, taste. I'm thinking potassium cyanide, to sleep, perchance to dream. Headlines, Chrysler heads back to bankruptcy court Friday. Crash diet, GM getting in shape for Chapter 11. Economy sinks at a 5.7 rate in the first quarter. We're a second world country and working on third, I tell you. We probably won't be able to make our own cars before long. The economy's croaking. So what we need to do is have a lot of expensive foreign wars. Anybody can see it. You can't run your own country? Then kill a bunch of 13th century peasants. That'll fix it. I think I may have to take over the economy. Yes, I hear you asking. Fred, what arrogance, even by your vertiginous standards. You aren't an economist. What makes you think you know anything about economics? To which I reply, what makes you think economists know anything about economics? Who got us into this mess, me or economists? I've never bought anything on credit in my life, and I have zero debt. Would you rather have me running things or economists? Headline, North Korea tests missiles. Oh, good. North Korea has the bomb and now missiles of short range. Short of how long the range is to Seoul and the American bases in South Korea. Bad juju, says my astute military mind. And so Hillary Clinton, former first housewife turned Millie Metternich, an expert on all things foreign, wants sanctions against North Korea. This makes perfect sense. They've got nuclear weapons, so let's piss them off. Sanctions will have no effect on their bomb, but may make them desperate enough to use it. What could be a better idea? Remember when George W. Huffenpuff was never going to let the malignant Northerners have the bomb? No, indeed. He was going to pyong their yang if they even thought about it. That worked, didn't it? Now President Black Bush is making threatening noises at Korea as if he could do anything about it. He's going to make those heathens behave and put the cost on the national credit card with the Bank of China. Headline, Army Chief, U.S. can fight North Korea if necessary. Yes, General George Casey, Army Chief of Staff, says we're ready. In the accompanying photo, he has the daft look of a moony Boy Scout. I've thought that officers must be issued some form of psychological disturbance when they sign up. Anyway, the U.S. economy is rattling its death rattle. Industry either leaves the country or goes sunward. America is now the world's greatest debtor nation, and this dazed silverhead bulldog wants another war. Why? What's wrong with the war we've got? Headline, Israel dismisses U.S. demand on settlements. I guess that doesn't leave much doubt about who controls Washington. Israel, being utterly dependent on the United States for its existence, is the one country that Washington should be able to dictate to. If the U.S. were an independent country and told the Knesset to wear tutus and toe shoes, in 10 minutes they'd be grunting their way through Swan Lake. I don't know, though. Given how the U.S. manages its own foreign policy, I can see why the Israelis might not be enthusiastic about American suggestions. Headline, Senator Lautenberg, U.S. won't be upset if Israel strikes Iran. Well, Senator Lautenberg, presumably an Arab, wouldn't be upset. But with which Americans has he consulted? Me? I guess I missed his call. Real answer. He's consulted with Congress, 535 comatized temple monkeys pawing through the ruins of America in search of bribes. The bicameral whorehouse on Capitol Hill works like a vending machine. You put coins in the slot, select your law, and the desired legislation slides out. Thing is, Israel can't attack Iran without American okay, which Iran knows. So that puts us at war with Iran, and our Iraqi colony shares a long border with Iran, while Israel doesn't.